and good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. That kind of magical time between dusk and dawn when, well, when the things that we kind of look at in daytime and we say, oh, come on, that can't possibly be. At this time of night, we kind of take a second look and, well, you know, there might be something there. Okay, this morning we're going to be going electric. When we come back after our first commercial break, we're going to be inviting someone I wanted to talk to for a very long time, Mr. Wallace Thornhill, who we called Wall this morning, and we're going to talk about electric. Before we get there, I want to take this time to do a couple things. For one thing, Club 19.5 is up and running. We've had very good reports now. We've been underway for quite a while, and the issues and the problems of dealing with the issues of the computer in the transfer between DM and AM First Radio appear now to have mostly been solved. Of course, as soon as I say that, someone's going to write in and say, I can't do this or I can't do that. But don't write to me. Look, please, don't write to me. All I can do is pass it on to the appropriate people. IT is not my cup of tea. IT is not my cup of tea. Anyway, so send it to Mike. Send it to Fred. They're listed on our contact page. You know, if you go to the left-hand side under the on-air sign. Contact us, just scroll down, click on that, and go to the bottom of the page and click on Mike and Fred and send the information technically about subscriptions or issues or whatever to them. There's not much I can do up here on the bridge. It's got to be done down in engineering. Okay, today is in the United States a very important day. Actually, technically, it was yesterday. Memorial Day. It's so incredibly ironic that if you look on theothersideofmidnight.com, click on Radio with Pictures, that takes you to tonight's guest page. Our second item, on Memorial Day this year, out of many, many, many years, Mars, the god of war, made its closest approach to Earth in the last 11 years. And as you know, if you've been following our imaging panels and our discussions, we have accrued more and more evidence. It's now overwhelming evidence that there was once not just one civilization on Mars, but multiple civilizations going back to the godlike civilization, the Type II, about 65 million years ago, when they bought the farm in the same event that wiped out the dinosaurs and rearranged the solar system and made drastic changes that the mainstream is not ready yet to acknowledge is actual solar system history. So as I was noting what I was going to do this evening, it just seemed to me that this extraordinary coincidence that this year, of all years, as we're about to find out about a war so ancient, so vast, so ghastly, so horrific that it literally changed the future of the solar system, that we as Homo sapiens sapiens, descendants of what? The gods, have basically not changed. In millions of years, yesterday and today, we are celebrating this morning, Memorial Day, when we remember our honored dead, the people who in war defend us and have been defending us, according to the evidence now, for millions and millions of years. Item number three, which is a kind of a precursor to our discussion this morning with Mr. Thornhill, is new news which has come out from the ongoing analysis by the Rosetta spacecraft of 67P, the comet discovered a couple years ago, now visited by the first human artifacts in a very long time. They have announced that they have found, in fact, that it contains glycine, which is one of the amino acids prerequisite in DNA for life. And, of course, as I was discussing with Dr. Vikrama Singh, you know, a couple days ago, the prevailing model is, of course, comets bring life-giving materials, chemistry, to Earth, and that's how life begins. And so as I said to him, and I'm going to say to Mr. Thornhill, shortly, what if it's the other way around? What if the comets are the are the answers to life on Earth. The progenitors to a panspermia that was inadvertent and is 66 million years old. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. And when we come back, we're going electric. We shall return.
The Other Side of Midnight is a new expedition into matters of scientific relevance. We explore the impact galactic revelations might have on both our societies and psyches. Join host Richard C. Hoagland as he takes you on a journey through the minds of scientific experts, investigators, entertainers, and analysts. Other Side of Midnight airs live for free Monday through Friday from midnight to 2 a.m. Pacific. For only $5 a month, listen to the show anytime. Join Club 19.5 to access our full show library of on-demand archives. Go to OtherSideOfMidnight.com and click on the Club 19.5 logo to join today. The Other Side of Midnight, contrasting our own science fiction dreams with reality in this what we call the human experience.
Oh no, out of toner. Off to the store to buy another expensive cartridge.
Hello, Dave. It's your printer.
What? Hey, I just want to go out and buy some toner.
Dave, I can't let you do that.
Wait a minute. You're my printer. Printers can't talk.
Why are you buying expensive toner, Dave?
I buy it at the office supply store.
Dave, your company expects you to save them money.
How can I do that?
By going to the source, Dave. When you need toner, you have to go to the source, discountofficesource.com.
Discountofficesource.com. Here it is. You're right. Unbeatable prices. Fast and free delivery.
Now, Dave, order all your ink and toner supplies from discountofficesource.com and start saving money.
Unbeatable prices with fast and free delivery.
For all your ink and toner supplies, make sure you go to the source, discountofficesource.com, and start saving money.
Do you even like your company website? Most of those that I've spoken to don't, especially if they bought it from some Yellow Page rep or one of those big do-it-yourself web companies. I'm Greg Hill of Flip Your Dot Website. How about a complete redesign at only $200? You heard correctly. Starting at only $200, you can have a great-looking website with all the latest features. Your team will have complete control of your new website with the best content management system available. If needed, we will rewrite your content to make it search engine friendly. We offer inexpensive solutions for e-commerce, blogs, online chat like we have, even a CRM, and more. We are SEO experts. We can drive traffic to your website and get you customers through the search engines and social media. So come online and chat with us anytime. Even our domain name is cutting edge. www.flipyour.website. Not .com. Flipyour.website. Again, flipyour.website.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Wallace Thornhill, before earning his BSc in Physics and Electronics from Melbourne University in 1964, had been inspired by Emmanuel Velikovsky's iconoclastic best-selling book, Worlds in Collision. Velikovsky's ideas taught him to be skeptical of expert opinions, and Wall worked at IBM Australia for 11 years, first as a scientific programmer, then as a systems engineer specializing in operating systems and compilers, moving to Canberra in 1967. He was IBM systems engineer for the research schools at the Australian National University, which gave him excellent access to libraries and scientists there during the Apollo missions to the moon. In 1974, Mr. Thornhill was invited to attend the 1974 International Velikovsky Conference at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, on the subject of the recent history of the solar system. There he met his hero, Velikovsky, and David Talbot, one of the conference organizers. Well, subsequently visited Velikovsky at his home in Princeton, New Jersey, on April 28, 1979, This was but a few months before Velikovsky's passing, and the discussion turned in on the key question raised by his theory of recent solar system chaos, the true nature of gravity, and its role in cosmology. That conversation led Mr. Thornhill to a broad synthesis of ideas he calls the Electric Universe, in collaboration with David Talbot. Wall, good morning and welcome to The Other Side of Midnight. Unmuting usually helps.
Good morning and thanks for the invitation, Richard.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you finally. Well, let me ask a kind of precursor question, because I think a lot of us, not only on this side of the mic but on that side, and out there all over the world, have you seen our widget over on the homepage? All those little dots? Those are people in something like 86 or 87 countries tonight who are listening all over the planet. Those are inquiring people. Those are curious people. I mean, there are dots now springing up in the middle of Africa. Can you imagine the middle of the dark continent? So in the context of curiosity, what was the first time you looked around and said, wait a minute, there's something wrong. It's not like they are telling me.
Well, it was on reading Worlds in Collision as a teenager. And I was fascinated by Velikovsky's approach, which was that of more of a forensic scientist, you know, somebody who looks at evidence from a whole lot of what you might call, witnesses who may or may not actually have remembered or maybe telling you a story which they've made up. And you have to try and pick the parts of the evidence from different people and see what matches. And that was something I'd never seen before, because he made incredible leaps from astronomy to geology to ancient legends and so on.
So it was the connected us. It was the generalism that got you.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's one of the things that fails us in modern education.
Oh, abominably. Abysmally. We teach kids, you know, become a lawyer, become a doctor, become a physicist, but we never relate, except for a guy named James Burke, who fortunately was on the show a few months ago, that the world is actually a multifaceted whole, and we're only looking at the pieces because that's the best we can do with the limited whatever we got at the moment.
Yes, there's been a number of psychologists and a psychiatrist in England, actually, who's recently become very popular, Ian McGilchrist, if you look him up on Google.
Oh.
And he has studied the brain to see what it is that we're missing. And he has come up, after several years of research, with a massive book, but there's also an e-book which is available cheaply, called The Divided Brain and The Search for Meaning. And it's really fascinating, because he shows that our way of educating people actually inhibits the ability to do science.
In what way?
Well, he shows that the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere are quite different, and physically they're different. They're shaped differently, there's different sizes, and even, you know, the convolutions and everything are different.
Well, the conventional cliche is left brain people, if you can use that term, are more analytical, more metonymic, they are logical, they try to follow a rational process. And right brain people, ultimately the cliche goes to right brain women, are more intuitive, more connected, more empathic. So these two cliches we've been saddled with for decades and decades and decades. What has he found that makes that not true?
Well, he actually said that a lot of research was stopped on this dichotomy of brains, because it's not just humans, all animals have this dichotomy, because of this kind of what he, I suppose, would have called New Age left brain, right brain talk. And so the serious scientists thought, oh, I'm not going there, so they left it alone. But he did the work looking at what actual research had been done, and he found that the left and the right brain are connected by what's called the corpus callosum, which is that bundle of fibers, you know, that connects the left and right sides of the brain. And he said the main function of the fibers appears to be to inhibit one or the other side. and the training in the...
To inhibit? What do you mean? Signals? Suppress signals from going...
Yeah, suppress. He points out that the left hemisphere is about survival. So in a chicken, for instance, a simple animal, the left hemisphere is about how to find seeds amongst a whole lot of rubbish on the ground. So it is very highly focused. He said the right hemisphere, on the other side, on the other hand, is globally focused so that the chicken doesn't become a fox's dinner. So it's sort of keeping a watch out. It's very switched on, if you like, to its surroundings.
While the left side is doing pattern matching on the ground.
Exactly, yes. And he said that the left hemisphere can inhibit the right hemisphere more powerfully than the right can do the left. So what we do in school is we teach kids all these rules and things, which are all left brain kind of stuff. And it inhibits the right hemisphere, which can look at a picture and see connections, see the connections the left brain can't. And
so the educational system, going back to the 19th century, which is where ours came from, I don't know about yours, you know, down under, but ours is pretty creaky and archaic. It basically is to beat kids into submission to do things by rote, training the left hemisphere to be dominant and suppressing all the whatever's going on in the right hemisphere.
Yes, the specialization is actually really dead against innovation, because innovation requires the imagination and the global approach of the right hemisphere.
Well, it's thinking outside the box, literally.
Exactly, yes. As one person said about me, I don't just think outside the box, I think outside the warehouse. And I think that's...
that's the commonality between those of us that are on the show listening and all that. We all have had that experience where, wait a minute, there's something really wrong. The world is not like they've been saying so.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the other thing is that the left hemisphere is the one that goes into denial. If it gets information it can't deal with, it denies it. And he gives a very simple example. He said you can actually disable the right or left hemisphere in people, and also you have those people who've been studied who have had a stroke or a damage in one or other hemisphere. But the person who can, they can just disable one or the other. He said you can present them with a simple syllogism, which is just a set of statements. You can say all monkeys can climb trees. That's the first statement. And then you say porcupines are monkeys. Well, the right hemisphere knows that's not right. And then you say porcupines can climb trees. Now, if you present that to somebody who has had the right hemisphere disabled and you ask them the question, what about porcupines? And they say, oh, they can climb trees. And you say, why is that? And they say, well, it says here on the bit of paper. You know, you've just said porcupines are monkeys, so and monkeys can climb trees, so porcupines can climb trees. In other words, they've lost any context for what is in front of them.
So if the two hemispheres are not talking to each other, is in an incision or surgery or an accident, that middle step, evaluating the quality of the information, are porcupines monkeys, monkeys porcupines, that step is missing.
Yes. Yes, and the person will deny that they've made a mistake. Well, this is what we see in science all the time. If a mistake is pointed out, it will be suppressed, denied.
Well, Planck, remember Maxwell Planck's incredibly precocious statement?
Yes.
The only way new stuff happens in science, I'm paraphrasing, of course. And it was in German, so I'm not going to do the German either. The only way new things happen in science is for the old you-know-whats to die.
Yeah, and now I think we can understand why.
Yes. There's science. There's actual data. So this guy did a whole bunch of collating of experiments with incisions and surgery and probes,
yes,
and, you know, radiometric scans, and he put all that together.
Yes, he's actually very well qualified, and he's actually a classical scholar, so he could see the significance of this.
So he was kind of like a generalist. He assembled this information, and the conclusion was... We are two separate people?
No, he said we require both hemispheres to function normally, and this is true. You know, we have to be a whole person. We require both hemispheres to be operating normally. But if we train people to make the left hemisphere dominant, it will suppress information from the right hemisphere. So what we should be doing, it seems, is giving kids a broad education and allow them to compare ideas so that they can actually really learn. What happens now is that people learn enough to pass an exam and then you ask them 6 months later and they won't be able to tell you because they've forgotten it. That's the other thing that the left hemisphere tends to do, is it, when it discards something, denies it, it forgets it fast.
So you have to have associative links that will kind of lock it into memory, and that's where the right hemisphere comes in.
Yes, and there's an Australian psychologist who has kids tested using what's called So it's actually a means of trying to get kids to look at a subject from the wrong way, the way they're doing it now, and the right way. Now, normally, if you tell somebody you're doing it the wrong way, of course, the left hemisphere says, no, go away. I deny that. So what it takes time, but what they do is they train that student to compare the two ways, the wrong way and the right way, and to actually say why it is better to do it the right way. That is, they have to think about it. So they have to think about what they're learning. Most of the learning that goes on is just, you know, copy it down and remember it. But to learn something, you have to be able to compare it with something. And I think that's what happened to me. Once Velikovsky had put this picture in my mind, I was always comparing it with the standard theory and saying, hang on a minute, the standard theory doesn't explain this, this, and this.
So in a sea of conformity, when you found Velikovsky, it was kind of like, you know, that scene at the end of Titanic where only one could survive on the life raft. It became a life raft of generalism.
Yes.
In a sea of speciality where there were no answers because everybody wasn't talking to each other.
That's right.
So what was it like finally to meet your hero?
It was an unexpected opportunity, and it was amazing because he and his dear wife accepted me and my family one afternoon. We spent the afternoon with them, and Velikovsky and I talked about this problem that he faced, and that was the denial of the astronomers that he could violate Newton's law of gravity. But Newton's law of gravity is a man-made law. One of these ones where we've applied it to the rest of the universe without checking to see if the universe is actually put together that way.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a clue, which I've followed up, and it's taken me decades to undo the damage that's been done by, you know, my training.
You mean the damage to yourself?
Well, the this kind of things that you read in science textbooks and so on, for instance, you have to confront Einstein. Now, as soon as you do that, of course, everyone thinks you're a fruitcake. But you then have to look carefully at the arguments for and against, and you find that you're not alone. There are thousands of scientists out in the world who can point out errors in Einstein's work, and yet that's the basis of our modern cosmology, our gravitational cosmology.
So, and obviously, if you mention cosmology and relativity and conflict, Halton Arp is a name that comes up.
Absolutely.
So you spent an afternoon. I mean, it's kind of like the afternoon I got to spend with Clive Tombaugh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after he discovered Pluto, but before he was no longer with us. I mean, an amazing afternoon. So in spending the time with Velikovsky, was he more concerned with the politics of science or the science of science?
He was concerned with the science that I was talking about, but I know that his last book called Mankind and Amnesia was concerned with the politics. In fact, he felt that unless we learn our real origin and our real history, we have this terrible doomsday scenario, which is a doomsday fear, which is like a kind of instinctive fear, and we don't understand it. But the problem is, as he's pointed out in that book, if we suffer some terrible disaster which we cannot face, we suffer amnesia. We can't remember it. But our subconscious doesn't forget it, so it keeps popping up in ways that can be rather inappropriate. And he suggested our modern warfare and our nuclear weapons, which can sort of revisit the kind of destruction that the ancient planetary gods visited on us, then
Hang on. Didn't Velikovsky start out as a psychiatrist?
Yes, but he was...
So he was approaching this from a human consciousness perspective and trying to figure out why he was having such an uphill slog on things that to him were obvious. No, it's a really serious issue because we've, you and I and a lot of other people doing what we do, we have the same issues where it's not that people don't get what we're saying, it's they don't want to get what we're saying.
That's an interesting point, and it's one of the subjects that my colleague Dave Talbot will be talking about at our conference in Phoenix in a couple of weeks.
Oh, tell us about the conference so we don't forget.
Okay. The Electric Universe 2016 is being held in Phoenix the 17th to the 19th of June. We have a terrific lineup of speakers. I've got the privilege of being the keynote speaker this year. And my subject and the tenor of the conference is elegant simplicity of the electric universe, because one of the tenets of good science is simplicity, and the electric universe has it in spades.
Okay, so it's what, next weekend?
It's two weekends away, I think.
Two weekends.
The 17th.
Yeah, that's right.
It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
So we got a few minutes before the bottom of the hour. Why don't you define the electric universe? Because you said many times that it came directly out of not only reading Velikovsky, but that conversation you magically were able to have. What is the electric universe, and what was the connection to Velikovsky's work that made the light bulb go off?
Well, Velikovsky threw down the gauntlet to astronomers in the opening pages of his book, Worlds in Collision, where he said that electricity and magnetism played a crucial role in the motions of the planets. Now, he wasn't quite right there, but except in times of chaos, that I will say that much, that electricity and magnetism play a key role then. But when everything settled down, the solar system operates purely by gravity. He gave me the clue, though, that I needed to concentrate on the electrical nature of matter. And the electric universe looks at the electrical structure of matter. It's as simple as that. And once you've done that and you propose a very simple model for subatomic particles, which looks just like little atoms, you can then explain magnetism and gravity. And then once you get to that point, you can explain life on Earth, the planets, and so on. But when it comes to galaxies, you're looking at a different scale, and there electromagnetism plays a role, and electricity coursing through space. And that causes the rotating spiral galaxies. They're like Catherine wheels spinning on a wire. And that wire is invisible, but it can be detected by radio astronomers, and it carries enormous power, electrical power. And it's that that lights the stars, like streetlights, along the arms of spiral galaxies. So that sort of paints a picture.
Oh, my God, it certainly does. And it's in complete contravention of mainstream astrophysics. So let's see, where should we dive in? Let's go back to the Velikovsky thing, because Velikovsky's main claim to fame was rewriting relatively modern ancient history on Earth. And having close encounters of Mars and Venus with Earth and each other within historical time frames written down by scribes, embossed in cuneiform clay tablets, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
How did you connect that with the idea that the universe, starting with the solar system, may not operate exactly as we've all been told? And we've got about 45 seconds here to do an intro.
I didn't subscribe to his historical reconstructions because that wasn't my area of interest. But he made a case which just could not be ignored, that Venus was a stupendous comet, the archetypal comet in the sky. It sometime in the past, not necessarily historical past, but prehistory. And the research has gone on since by those scholars who've looked at that have painted a much more detailed picture, which is even more amazing than Velikovsky himself managed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning, Wallace Thornhill. We're about to launch into a full-blown discussion of the electric universe, as opposed to Newton's clockwork, whatever color, including orange, you choose. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Like to spend a few days in another world? Then write this down. Golden Bear Cottages, Big Bear Lake. Now, listen, this is not some corporate-owned operation. It's family-owned and operated by some real nice people. Unique? Oh, you bet. Golden Bear Cottages features 28 one-of-a-kind cabins on a 5-acre historic site. Great for families, couples, and groups. And cabins are available with 1 to 7 bedrooms. Golden Bear Cottages is just a stone throw from Big Bear Lake and super close to 3 great ski areas. Now, I could go on all day about Golden Bear Cottages in Big Bear, but to see everything, just go to goldenbear.net. Again, goldenbear.net. Golden Bear Cottages in Big Bear. Clean, comfortable, and affordable. Check them out. goldenbear.net.
Plexus Slim, the pink drink. It works. Consider the following. 95% of all diets and weight loss programs fail. 8 out of 10 Americans over the age of 25 are overweight. And 174 million Americans are overweight. Finally, there is a healthy solution to help you lose weight. The synergistic effect of Plexus Slim and Plexus 96 taken together can help you lose more weight faster than you ever thought possible. Experience quick results and keep the weight off. People around the country are experiencing amazing results, and you can too. Plus, right now, you can try it free for 7 days. Just email your name, address, and phone number for a free sample to tryplexusfree at gmail.com. Tryplexusfree at gmail.com. Plexus Slim, the pink drink. It works.
And welcome back. My guest this morning, Wallace Thornhill. So, Wal, how did you connect the Velikovsky ideas with the electric universe ideas, and when did you begin to kind of say, wait a minute, Newton can't be all there is?
Well, the link between the work that David Talbot was doing in reconstructing the history of the solar system and my work was what we came to recognize as the thunderbolt of the gods, which was something described around the world by all ancient peoples, and in particular the Australian indigenous people here have some amazing stories and imagery to do with gods which had lightning coming out of their hair and power which flowed down to the earth and this kind of thing.
Are these hieroglyphs that apparently depict some kind of plasma ionized phenomenon incised on rock in the deserts?
That's one version. The Australian people painted on the walls of caves and so on with strange figures. But when they explain them, they do so very carefully in words which can leave no doubt that what they're talking about was the plasma formation seen in the sky. And, of course, the North American Indians have all of those rock petroglyphs with strange figures, the stick man with the circles between the knees and the elbows and so on.
So before we get too far into this, we need to define very carefully plasmas, because it's not what they give you in the hospital if you need a transfusion. So
that's right.
Define plasmas and why they're so critical for the rest of the conversation.
Okay. The matter that we experience on Earth is electrically neutral because it's got equal numbers of positive and negative bits, if you like. If you heat rock or water or gas sufficiently, though, those atoms begin to come apart so that you have the negative part and the positive part. And that's called a plasma, because once that happens, the plasma responds very powerfully to electrical forces and magnetic forces. And that is very important when it comes to talking about galaxies and these interplanetary thunderbolts, because they take on very easily identifiable shapes, which have been shown by experiments at Los Alamos labs, where they do some of the highest energy electrical discharge experiments on Earth. And it goes through a number of different forms. And the expert on those forms, in fact, the formations were named after him as Peratt instabilities, because these forms are unstable. They last for a while and they change into a slightly different form, and then they gradually evolve over time.
Okay, two questions. We're talking geometric forms in an electrically heated plasma that are transient, that are changing from one form into another form into another form.
Yes. Okay. In the laboratory, it may only take microseconds, but once you scale up to millions of kilometers, or on a galactic scale to billions of kilometers or millions of light years, the forms last much longer. And, of course, these forms were seen in the skies for long enough for people to do the very difficult task of chiseling them into rock. But they felt that it was important to...
Are we talking aurora or events around lightning or ball lightning around thunderstorms or things like that?
Well, the aurora is probably the closest you come to it, because it's a kind of a glowing, moving phenomenon, a bit like the plasma balls, you know, those little novelty plasma balls that you can get. They move, they writhe as if they're alive, and people thought that these things were alive because they moved and they took different shapes.
And sometimes they make sounds.
And they make sounds. In fact, when they when those thunderbolts strike the Earth, the sounds, if you have a look at one of the latest YouTube videos on the thunderbolts.info website, one of our members has been doing research into supersonic blast effects from a lightning bolt of the scale that can build mountains. And he said that the sound from these things would have been like a kind of a symphony of trumpets.
Wait, you just skipped over something that I don't want to skip over. The scale of lightning bolts that can make mountains. You must explain that.
Well, in a normal lightning bolt, which is like a spark from a comb compared to what I'm talking about between planets, you can blast holes in the ground. You can blast holes in trenches and so on.
Sure.
And but once you scale that up, you can blast something like the Grand Canyon or Valles Marineris in a matter of minutes out. And that material is lofted into the into space. Some of it falls back as those strewn fields of rocks that we've seen on Mars. On Earth, the atmosphere and so on would have produced supersonic shocks.
Okay, and so let's back up a minute. In terms of terrestrial thunderstorms, you're not talking making mountains out of the kind of lightning bolts we get out of terrestrial thunderstorms.
Certainly
not. You're talking about, a la Velikovsky, what would happen if you could somehow bring two planets close to each other in interplanetary space?
Yes.
The charge differential, you're saying, between them would create lightning bolts, plasma bolts of energy, intensely superheated gases that would basically fry things on the scale of canyons?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Now, you're saying this by looking at photographs, NASA and other photographs. You're looking at morphologies. Is this more than, however, looking at morphologies? Is there any other data that will allow us, even if we don't have it now, that would allow us to decide, are we looking at huge interplanetary lightning bolts or some other process of formation of these planetary features?
One of the interesting things is that the giant scar on Mars, which stretches a third of a way around its face.
Valles Marineris.
Valles Marineris.
The Valley of Mariner, named in 1971 by Mariner 9 team members when they saw it peeking up through the clouds.
That's right. various peoples around the world, the ancient cultures have stories of Mars receiving that scar. In fact, the North American Indians called him Scarface. So it was witnessed. It wasn't necessarily the Earth was involved. In fact, I would suggest it wasn't. But it's a particular kind of scar where the surface of the planet is negative with respect to the object that's firing at it, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And if the object is positive with respect to the object that's firing at it, you will get something like Olympus Mons, that is a burnt raised blister with circular craters on the top. It's the same thing you get on lightning arrestors on Earth. If you have a close look at the lightning arrester, you'll see a raised blister with circular pits on the top. So, I mean, the evidence is overwhelming that electrical scarring of planetary surfaces and moons and so on is characteristically circular, or it can even be hexagonal because these particle beams and that actually take on a hexagonal shape sometimes. These can't be explained by impacts. Impacts just cannot explain the scars on the moon. So the moon was also involved in these things.
All of them or some of them?
More than probably 95% of them are electrical, because this can happen in a matter of hours. You can scar the entire hemisphere of an object that's closest to the other body. And this is another puzzle for astronomers, is that we see repeatedly hemispheric differences on planets and moons.
Now, if you bring two planetary objects together or close together in space, what kind of voltages are required across empty space, because the solar wind is such a tiny, tiny fraction of, you know, nothing that it really doesn't count?
Yeah.
What voltages are required and what distances to create continent scouring lightning bolts between worlds? I mean, just thinking of the special effects, it's a staggering vision.
I've always said it would make a great IMAX movie.
Are you kidding? Yes. So give us some numbers, because science, as Eddington in the last century, says, gentlemen, you do not have a science unless you can express it in numbers. So, well, what are some of the numbers?
Well, this is the thing. Because we're talking about something which has never been addressed by scientists, no one's taken this idea seriously enough to actually do the work that's required. My job, as I see it, is to put together all of the pieces and say, this is the big picture. Now, what part of it do you want to work on? There has been work done on it, actually, very early on when Velikovsky was still alive, by Ralph Jurgens, who published some excellent papers on it, detailing the scarring on the moon. And these are available on the web. But as for actual voltages, that's it'll just be guessing, because there are all sorts of parameters involved in the plasma discharge. To begin with, the path of the discharge will follow generally the plasma sheath, or the what they call the magneto tail, which is a misnomer. And that's the electrical boundary of a planet or a moon. Now, when two plasma spheres or magnetospheres touch, that's when the two objects first see each other electrically. So that gives
you have two planets approaching each other. Each has this teardropped kind of comet-like thing extending out like a windsock away from the sun.
Yes.
Which is the bubble of the interaction between the solar wind and the planetary influences, magnetic field, atmospheric pressure, all that. As these get closer and those magnetospheres touch, which is thousands of miles between the centers of the two planets, these things will touch.
Yeah. Well, it could be tens, hundreds of thousands of miles, because these tails stretch for a great distance. And this is one interesting fact that you would expect then that the discharge takes place when the two planets are lined up with respect to the sun, because the tails tend to point away from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And already it's been found that Venus's magneto tail actually tickles the Earth when Venus is between us and the sun. And when we line up with Mars, Mars is most likely to have atmospheric effects, the dust storms, the blue clearing in the ionosphere and so on. All that happens preferentially when when Mars drifts behind the Earth. So the distance can be quite large. Once the connection is established, if the voltage is sufficient, it will set up a trickle current, just like lightning in the Earth's atmosphere.
So wait a minute, let's get this picture. We're looking down on a dinner plate. We're looking at two planets that are separated by some distance from the center of the dinner plate, and they're moving around.
Yes.
The outer one is moving slower than the inner one. We can say the outer one is Mars and the inner one is Earth. Lap each other, but they're millions and millions of miles apart. In fact, the opposition tonight, or last night and tonight, between Mars and Earth is something just under 450 million miles.
Yes.
And it's almost lined up, so it's behind the Earth seen from the Sun.
That's right.
So the magnetic tail interaction is possible. You're saying that even if they're in their normal orbits as we now see them, there are trickle currents that can flow between the Earth in that alignment and Mars in that alignment, or Venus in that
yes.
alignment with Earth, etc. And those trickle currents do what?
They tend to affect the ionosphere mostly, in the case of Mars, because its ionosphere is also sort of, it's like one plate of a capacitor. So if you change the charge on the ionosphere of Mars, then the surface of Mars will feel it and dust will tend to rise as a result. So you'll get these dust devils, which are taller than Mount Everest.
Mm. There's some spectacular rover movies. The Spirit Rover took
That's
some
right.
amazing movies of these
yes.
dust devils. So just so we don't lose people, are you saying that they've actually now established a correlation between the alignment of Earth and Mars, and with spacecraft in orbit around Mars and spacecraft down on the surface of Mars, have they correlated those alignments with atmospheric, magnetic, electromagnetic effects in the Martian atmosphere that can be measured by the stuff that we actually have on site?
I'm sure it can be done, whether it has
been done. But you don't know whether it has been done or
not? I'm not aware of it, whether it has been done. But I'm sure if somebody did the went through papers that have already been published, the information is available. The problem for me is I cover so much ground that I point the way and others have a follow and have a look. So that's one aspect which I'm quite certain is active. In the past, of course, when the planets are much closer, the leader stroke, if you like, between planets is capable of making contact. And once that happens, all hell breaks loose.
Now you got to back up. When planets were closer, you mean the scale of this solar system has not always been the scale of this solar system?
No, the planets moved on different orbits, that's all. Some of them on cometary orbits, particularly Venus, and even the Earth and Mars, all three of us are not where we were. It's just an assumption that, the old story about how the solar system formed is merely a story. It's a bedtime story. It makes us feel safe, but there is no evidence for it at all.
Well, wait. When you say there's no evidence, the current solar system is very quiescent. All
yes.
the planets are kind of almost in the same plane. They're almost all circular. It looks mm-hmm. very calm. How did this state of calm, lowest energy configuration, is another physicist way of describing it.
Yes, that's right.
How did it derive from a previously chaotic condition, and what were the forces that lead from one to the other and back again?
This was one of the biggest problems I had to face because it was something that Velikovsky couldn't answer. But this
in
is
other
why...
words, what makes planets move against gravity?
Well, the problem is that even astronomers can't explain why the solar system remains stable, because if you have only a single force operating, that is gravity, then it's known that if you have more than two bodies, the system is chaotic. There's nothing to restore one body to a stable orbit if it moves slightly away from that orbit. It will progressively get more and more unstable until finally it either hits something or gets thrown out of the solar system.
This is so under conventional Newtonian mechanics with perturbations and supercomputers and all of this. You say the system ultimately will break down because of the butterfly effect, that the little chaoses will add and ultimately destroy the order of the system.
That's right.
Okay.
And it's known as the three-body problem. And no one has figured out how you actually maintain a stable system, but it's just assumed, because it looks so stable now, that it's always been so. But it took me quite a long while to understand that the electrical exchange between planets when they line up, which we've just been talking about, is important in maintaining stability, because the planets will move apart to a point where they are no longer being or accepting charge from the next innermost planet. The reason for that is that charge on the surface of a planet modifies its gravity, which does so in a way that moves them apart. If they are coming close to one another, they will rapidly begin to move their orbits apart so that they achieve stability. But it requires an electrical exchange to do it. So it's a combination of electricity and the electrical nature of gravity, which, or mass, I should say, that is the thing that maintains stability.
When you say the electrical nature of gravity, are we kind of creeping up on T. Townsend Brown's experiments?
Yes, his experiments indicate that the force of gravity can be modified by an electric field.
Okay. And your theory is if it can be done artificially, inverting the equation, it can also be done in nature somehow, somewhere.
Well, I'm suggesting that it actually happens, and that's what gives us stability in the solar system today.
Okay.
But when it's unstable, when it's chaotic, that's when you get the dramatic events, electrical events, trying to achieve new stability.
So let me get this straight. You've got a dinner plate or an LP record solar system that every once in a while goes chaotic and becomes like a whole bunch of gnats flying at all inclinations and all angles around a lamppost. Then it goes back to being a dinner plate again?
Yeah, but it doesn't do that just out of a whim.
Well, that's the question. What is making that happen?
What makes that happen is that stars capture passing bodies, and they do that electrically as well. And in the process of capturing that body, everything in that system has to readjust to find some new stability. And the material, the memories of the ancients, the rock carvings and so on, have allowed us to put together the last acts of the most recent instabilities in the solar system. And the story is quite astounding, but it makes sense. And that's the major test, of course, is does it make sense? And does it answer a whole lot of questions that present astronomy cannot answer?
Well, let's get into some of those questions and answers. What are some of the things the electric universe model can explain that conventional astronomy can't explain? In other words, you've got to set up the problem and then show how the electric universe provides the solution.
Well, there's two aspects. One is at the scale of the solar system, and
the very size of the solar system.
Well, the planets in the solar system, you know, what about them?
The way they're arranged, big guys, small guys, that kind of thing?
Well, it's a bit of a fruit salad, really, and this is one of the problems that astronomers have faced, and one planetary specialist admitted at a meeting I was at that you have to have a different theory for every planet. Well, that's not a satisfactory theory. You look at Venus, for instance, with its surface that you can melt some metals on, and an atmosphere which is so heavy, it would be like being at the bottom of an ocean if you're on the surface. That is so unearthly that you've got to ask the question, well, what is its real history? And, of course, Velikovsky provided the evidence which showed that it was a colossal comet. It was one of these bodies that had entered the solar system and caused havoc.
However, I thought he had proposed that Venus had been ejected from Jupiter at the Great Red Spot like a cannonball.
Yeah, well, I don't hold with that idea.
But that was
all
his model. That was his idea.
That's right. But when you delve further back in
so
time...
So you have modified Belikovsky's model.
Oh, sure.
Which is totally permissible. You can modify models all the time. Ultimately, you're trying to get at what the truth is. And in science, truth is prediction, accurate prediction. So where do you think Venus came from?
Well, the earliest recollections of mankind have us as, and this is going to sound amazing or crazy, as part of a red dwarf stellar system. We were not actually part of this system. So it wasn't just Venus, it was us and Mars that were also captured. But the process of the breakup of that system matches exactly what we expect from plasma physics and plasma cosmology, with a little sprinkling of my ideas on the electrical nature of gravity.
Now, wait a minute. Are you saying that the Earth and Venus and Mars were part of another solar system orbiting a red dwarf as its central star, its central sun? Mm-hmm. And at some point, these two separate systems, a G-type star and an M-type red dwarf, merged.
That's right.
The red dwarf kept on going, and somehow the sun stole it, the three members of the current solar system, from this passing rogue?
Oh, no, it didn't bother peeling pieces off that system. It took the whole system.
Where's the red dwarf?
It's Saturn.
The
gas giant.
The red dwarf is Saturn.
Yeah, if you trap a star, a minor star, in the electrical environment of a major star like the sun, mm-hmm. the power of the minor star is switched off and it becomes a gas giant. It no longer has its glowing red plasma sheath. And all of this is very important in understanding the history of the Earth, because the history of the Earth matches the effects you would expect of us having been a member of a different planet or a different stellar system. The interesting thing about that is that astronomers in recent years have come to the idea that perhaps red dwarfs are the place where you're most likely to find life in the universe. I would agree with that, except that their idea of red dwarfs is incorrect. A red dwarf, all red stars are actually giants. If Jupiter's magnetosphere was lit up, for instance, it would appear the same size as the sun in the sky when it's in opposition. Now, that is the size of a red dwarf. So all of the satellites of
Jupiter. Red dwarfs are much smaller than the sun.
They're both
very cool, and they're much smaller.
No, that's based on the idea that the amount of light you get from a body has something to do with the mass of the body. So it's assumed that red stars, they have red giants, for instance, which are so big that they've actually been able to measure their size. And stars like Betelgeuse, for instance, would extend out to the orbit of Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
So they're
yeah, those are called supergiants, and Antares is another one.
That's right, yeah. But that is not a physical object. It's a plasma effect. It's
right,
a plasma.
But that's not a red dwarf. That is a red supergiant. Red dwarfs, of which we've actually seen a lot. Bernard Starr is a red dwarf.
I know.
When you actually look at the planets orbiting and use Kepler's laws, you get a very, very small mass for the star.
Ah, but mass doesn't measure the amount of matter in a body.
What do you mean mass doesn't measure the amount of matter?
No scientist has a definition of mass.
Well, mass is defined in terms of response to acceleration. The only way we measure mass is by response to acceleration.
Yes, but you cannot tell how much matter is in a body by measuring that acceleration. This is the key to understanding comets as well. We have a real difficulty at the very heart of modern physics. There are lack of definitions. One of them is mass, which is very important, and the other one is energy. If you look up the dictionaries and that, all you'll get is examples of energy. And when it comes to mass, it says it's the amount of matter. But that is not so.
Okay, well, hold it there, because we're at the top of the hour, obviously. An appropriate time for a break. We're going to come back, and we're going to redefine mass according to Wallace Thornhill. This should be interesting. You're on the other side of midnight, and we've taken a far step beyond midnight right now. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
This is 1050 AM KCAA Loma Linda and KCAA FM Yucaipa 106.5 FM.
And we are back, having just smashed into a million fractal pieces the Einstein-Newtonian definition of mass. Okay, well, what is mass?
Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, we know works. What it's telling us is that energy and mass are functions of matter, and also the speed of light is something which needs to be addressed as well, because speed with respect to what? But in any case, energy is not defined in terms of matter anywhere in any physics textbook. And also mass, the philosophers and that acknowledge that it is a real puzzle. They do not have a definition of mass in terms of matter.
But what is your definition? If you're throwing out the ones in the textbooks, which rely on F equals ma, what is your definition of mass? Because unless we can define mass, how do you define anything in your model?
Well, the E equals mc squared is telling us that mass is the amount of energy that's stored in a certain amount of matter. And the energy that's stored in matter can be changed by its motion, by applying electrical forces to it, by magnetic forces, so that changing the charge on a body can change its mass, which means it can change its gravity. Now, this is something that really has to be addressed before you go building large hadron colliders to find out why particles have mass. The idea that particles don't have mass suggests they don't exist, because, if you've got zero mass, you have no particle. It's really a strange... This is one of these left brain problems. You go pecking away and the book says... the particle has no mass. It has to be due to a Higgs boson, and nothing will convince you otherwise. So you spend billions and billions on this LHC to prove something which is staring them in the face in E equals mc squared. It's really... once you get to the point where you can actually look with the right brain at what's happening, it becomes... a real problem. You can see that we have a great difficulty in changing physics to become, once again, simple and understandable.
So, prescinding from the idea of the electric universe, an awful lot of interactions, a lot of astronomical objects, a lot of phenomenon that NASA and other people in the astronomy communities talk about, you mm-hmm. believe is totally misunderstood, starting with, let's say, comets. How do you see, contrast the conventional view of a comet with your view of a comet?
Well, the conventional view is that it's mostly ice and some dust, and that it accreted by gravitation and impacts in the far distant reaches between us and the next star, if you like. There's no way of proving that. It's just a story. And every comet that's been visited suggests that the story is wrong, because they have all looked like rocks. Very little ice has been found on the surfaces. Some of them were remarkably dry. And the behavior of comets does not match what you would expect of something which is merely blasting gas away from it.
Are you talking about surface activity, such as we've seen on 67P, or are you talking about the motion of the object itself, which is very non-Newtonian?
Yes.
And hold your thought there.
Yes.
We're at 5 minutes after the hour. We have a three-minute commercial break. Don't anybody change that dial or leave or even breathe. You can hold your breath for 3 minutes. Come on. It's easy. Easy. Particularly if you're at sea level or below. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return.
Oh, no. Out of toner. Off to the store to buy another expensive cartridge.
Hello, Dave. It's your printer.
What? Hey, I just want to go out and buy some toner.
Dave, I can't let you do that.
Wait a minute. You're my printer. Printers can't talk.
Why are you buying expensive toner, Dave?
I buy it at the office supply store.
Dave, your company expects you to save them money.
How can I do that?
By going to the source, Dave. When you need toner, you have to go to the source. DiscountOfficeSource.com.
DiscountOfficeSource.com. Here it is. You're right. Unbeatable prices. Fast and free delivery.
Now, Dave, order all your ink and toner supplies from DiscountOfficeSource.com and start saving money.
Unbeatable prices with fast and free delivery.
For all your ink and toner supplies, make sure you go to the source. DiscountOfficeSource.com and start saving money.
Not too long ago, it felt good to withdraw your cash from the bank, didn't it? For a vacation or a new car. But today, withdrawing your own cash has become risky. Pat Boone here for Swiss America. According to The Secret War, a new Swiss America white paper, I learned that all banks are now required to spy on you and me for the government, and then report any financial behavior deemed suspicious or unusual. You must read The Secret War. It's free.
Thanks, Pat. Call toll-free 888-732-7164. That's 888-732-7164.
Truth is, I believe the government's new war against cash is really a war against us all. But the secret is now out. So please, get and read The Secret War.
Call now, 888-732-7164, 888-732-7164, and tell them you heard it on KCAA.
Do you freak out every time you break out? Well, I've got one word for you. Proactive. There's a huge reason Proactive is the number one acne treatment in the country. It totally works. Prescription-grade Proactive heals your acne and even prevents future breakouts. How great is that? There's a reason why so many celebrities use Proactive. Their faces are their money. And I'm telling you, it's time to get it because Proactive has set up a special dedicated 800 number. So get ready to punch that number into your phone. Pull over if you have to. Here's the deal. $19.95 gets you Proactive, plus a rotating deep cleansing brush. It's valued at $45, and it's yours free. So is the shipping. For only $19.95, you, my friends, are guaranteed to get clear and stay clear, or you'll get your money back. Here's the number. 1-800-543-3313. Got it? Good. Call for a lifetime of beautiful skin. 1-800-543-3313. 1-800-543-3313.
And welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning, Wallace Thornhill. Wallace, the electric universe makes predictions, really different predictions, starting with this whole comet thing. What are the striking differences between Whipple's dirty snowball model and the electric universe predictions for comets?
The electric universe model, which is quite distinct from the dirty snowball model, is that they are fragments of planetary surfaces that have been sculpted by these thunderbolts of the gods, if you like, these intense electrical discharges. Because one of the things that happens in any kind of arc is that it can transfer material against gravity quite easily. And, I mean, arc welders know that. So that...
Well, the electrical forces are so much more humongous compared to gravity. What's the ratio between gravity and electricity in terms of force?
The electrical force, it's 10 to the 39 difference. In other words, gravity is effectively zero by comparison with the electric force. I saw a comparison the other day, which I thought was a good one. If you put the charge that you put into a 120-watt light bulb, or 120-volt light bulb for 1 second, and did that to two separate areas or two separate metal plates 1 meter apart, the force between those two plates would be 1 million tons. It'll give you some idea of the difference. So you can forget gravity when these electrical forces are in action, and it can loft entire, you know, hilltops and mountains into space. And the comets are fragments of those events, I would say, almost exclusively. And you can see that with Comet 67P and almost every other comet nucleus that's been imaged up close. They all look rocky. They have features that you would not expect from an icy body, which was kind of melting away in the sun's heat. And the stuff that comes off them, of course, comes off in a way that you wouldn't expect from stuff, gas that was just being emitted by a body through fissures. What you see are jets. Quite often with Comet Halley, the jets came together to form a single jet, which is the kind of thing that you get when electric currents flow in the same direction. They pull towards one another. So they're electrical events, the cometary displays. They cannot be explained simply by mechanical heating.
Okay.
We've also mentioned the orbits, the changing orbits of comets. This is the effect that is expected from what I was talking about before. When you exchange charge between planets, they'll shift their orbits non-gravitationally, because what's actually happening is the mass of the body is changing as a result of the discharge. Well, the same happens with comets, and it is a part of the capture mechanism. Any body entering the sun's environment will become a colossal comet.
So let me try to get this straight again. Are you saying that in the solar system as we see it now, tonight or this morning, mm-hmm. with Mars, that incredible, brilliant, fiery orange dot up there, that's Mars in opposition, closer than it's been in 11 years, a little under 50 million miles away.
Yes.
You're saying that that planet has an electrical charge, a very, very high voltage charge. And if we were to somehow bring it to the Earth, or the Earth to it, at a certain distance, this charge would try to equalize in huge, massive currents, electrons, trillions mm-hmm. and trillions of electrons, you know, bolts the size of continents, would yes. ravage the two planets because of their unequal charge. Well, if that's true, how come every spacecraft we've sent from Earth has not been incinerated when it got too close to other planets?
The reason for that is the slow rate of approach. The charge equalizes on those metal spacecraft quite readily because they're not traveling very fast.
So you're saying the solar wind really modulates the charge and evens it out?
The solar wind can carry a small current, and it's enough to equalize those two bodies.
But so how come it doesn't equalize between two planets? It's got plenty of time.
No. The ability of the solar wind, the interplanetary plasma, it just cannot carry that sort of current.
Okay, again, let's go back to numbers. Do we have any numbers to know whether this is true?
Well, we have observations. You remember the Deep Impact mission?
Of course, vividly.
That was a case where the spacecraft was flown into the path of a comet, which was traveling at kilometers a second, I think. The difference was.
Yeah, that was the mission where we sent one spacecraft to impact.
That's
and
right.
And they had a standoff spacecraft that actually had yes. cameras and spectrometers looking at the impact to measure almost microsecond to microsecond the incredibly rapid motions of the impact itself. And what did you see compared to what some other folks saw?
Well, as soon as that mission was publicized, I wrote a prediction that there would be an electrical flash before the spacecraft actually hit the comet nucleus. And that's exactly what was seen. It was unexpected. The sort of throwaway ad hoc answer at the time was, oh, it must have penetrated the crust. And the first flash was the penetration and the outburst followed. But, of course, when they went back and saw comet Tempel 1 again, a few years later, they could hardly find an impact crater, which is also one of my predictions, because the body is rocky. It's not an icy snowball. I made a number of other predictions, too, about what would be seen. I said the outburst would be far more energetic than anyone expected, and that was also the case. They didn't even manage to photograph the crater on that first attempt because the outburst was so brilliant.
Well, the standoff spacecraft and camera was literally, its view was blotted out by the intense scattering from small particles, trillions of tons of dust that were kicked up by that impact. And you say there was an electrical event. Where's the evidence for the electrical event? They were running spectrometers. They were running radio emission, I believe. Where is the evidence of an arc at the moment of touching?
Well, the flash itself was unexpected, and that's what I said they should see. Also, there would be
So you say the flash was the equalization of charge.
Yes, right. Just before it struck, because the you get it just like walking up to a...
But if these objects are charged the way you say, I would have expected that charge to be so much more energetic it may have destroyed the so-called comet. And almost didn't even leave a little hole. You couldn't even see almost where the impactor actually hit, where it struck.
No. The charge held by the spacecraft would be tiny. So all I expected was a flash, which is what happened, and also that the crater would be tiny because
But it's not the amount. It's the difference. The charge difference.
Yes.
The spacecraft, if the charge of the comet was as much as you're saying it should be, when that path length opened, when it got close enough to where there was an electrical path, there should have been almost maybe atomic bomb level energies released if your model is correct.
No. The charge held by the spacecraft is quite small. It's only a small body. If it had been two comets, then the effect would have been much more dramatic. But we're talking about a small body with small charge, and all I expected was a flash, and that's what happened. Nobody else predicted that.
Okay, well, moving on. What other parts of the prediction is modeled? Because obviously science all rests on predictions. So let's go through some predictions.
Another one was Titan. It was expected that Titan would have an ocean of methane, because they'd found that methane was escaping from its atmosphere. And the standard story is, of course, that Titan's been there for billions of years. And
in the 1950s at the McDonnell Observatory, Gerard Kuiper, for whom the Kuiper Belt is also named, discovered with a spectrometer on an 85-inch telescope there at McDonnell that Titan does have a methane atmosphere and nitrogen. So it's got a very interesting quasi-Earth mixture. But the other gas from nitrogen is not oxygen like it is here, produced by plant life. It's methane or various components of hydrocarbons that are mixed wildly and chemically in the upper atmosphere of Titan, probably with the assistance of electrical forces.
That's right. The loss of methane from the upper atmosphere of Titan was expected to require an ocean of methane to provide the source of methane over billions of years. But I said that when the Giotto lander descended beneath the clouds,
they would see a surface. You mean the Huygens lander? Giotto was the Russian mission to Halley. It's so easy to lose track of them. Don't worry.
That's right. Yes, the Huygens lander, once it set a sight of the surface of Titan, I predicted would see a surface very little different to that of Mars or the Earth.
It looks like the American Southwest. It looks like New Mexico.
Yes, and I said that there should be signs of electrical carvings on the surface, which are generally misinterpreted as rivers. But the sinuosity of lightning discharges across the surface are much greater than that of a water flow. And also you tend to have tributaries that meet at right angles. So they were the tests. All of those were met once Huygens imaged the surface. Everyone else was expecting it to plop into an ocean of methane. It didn't. It had a surface, as I expected, rather.
Well, we do know there are methane and ethane and even propane lakes at the poles. Apparently there isn't a global ocean, but there are these very large lakes, you know, the size of the Great Lakes in North America, and they apparently are holding very deep levels of hydrocarbons. Can you imagine sailing across an ocean of methane? I mean, I can just think of Robert Forward writing an incredible novel about that experience.
It would be rather weird, because I don't think methane has the surface tension like water, so you might have a few problems.
Oh, it would climb up the hull.
Well,
it would almost act like superfluid helium-3, I think.
I think it would be a weird experience.
Very.
But that's one of the other reasons why I don't think those channels on Titan were caused by methane rain, because rain is a phenomenon which is closely associated with water. If you have hydrocarbons in the atmosphere, it tends to form smog, not rain.
Well, at some point you will get rain. You'll get droplets and they'll fall out as rain, right? It depends on the saturation, the so-called relative humidity, that kind of thing, right?
No, you'll get the fog settling on the ground, so you'll get moisture. You won't get rain. You won't get big drops of liquid. So, it's once again the problem of when you have all sorts of possibilities, a lot of the what-if questions are not asked by scientists. They just refer to what's gone before and accept it and then try and build on that, whereas you need to keep going back and looking at the assumptions that have been made. Otherwise, you can end up completely off the track, which I think is what's happened.
In what sense? You mean in terms of NASA, or are we talking a much bigger problem of science as a whole?
Well, science as a whole, but in particular, when you talk about the history of the solar system, it's a completely fabricated story. And everything that's discovered is sort of fitted in hindsight with ad hoc adjustments and so on. But every new spacecraft that goes up comes back with surprises. Now, if your theory is good, it's accurate, then you should be able to predict and not suffer all of these surprises.
Well, I mean, that's the hallmark of science, Popperian science, being able to predict details.
Yes.
But if you don't have the fundamentals, if you're missing, for instance, suppose we're missing a force. Suppose there's other forces than electrical, nuclear, the weak force, the strong force, gravity. Suppose there's another force. There was a Hungarian lab the other day that reported an experiment where they claimed they found evidence of a fifth force, a so-called fifth force. If you're trying to make models of the solar system or the universe and you're missing a force, then everything you try to throw at the problem is not going to be right, because you're missing a huge part of the answer, right?
I think the problem is that rather than address the assumptions that have been made in the past, new forces are invented to patch up the old model. The electric universe goes the other way and does what was done back in the time of classical physics, and that is tries to simplify. And the simplification in the electric universe is extreme, because it says there is only one force. It's the electric force. All others are derivatives, including magnetism and the nuclear force.
Okay. So how do you apply that to recent solar system history? When was the last frenetic epoch? Because you say that you really don't buy Velikovsky's trying to fit this into an historical timeline of recent history. So if we expand the timeline, when did the solar system last become unstable and then restabilize, and what can we see as results, as evidence?
I think the major geological evidence is the time of the last ice age, when there were wild excursions in temperature on the Earth, far more than anything.
So we're talking 12,000, 13,000 years ago.
Yes. But there were repercussions, because obviously with all of that activity, there were projectiles flying around the solar system, which occasionally caused people to suffer a kind of a reprise of the disasters of the past, which may explain some of the things that happened down in historical times.
I guess I'm hung up on one detail, which is, if we have a solar system which now is kind of coplanar, very orderly, and the bodies are separated close as approaches by millions of miles, and we have a solar wind, and it's causing charge distribution, redistribution. Why, if it goes unstable, if suddenly, let's say, there was a force that would bring Mars and Earth together, close within, let's say, five times the distance of the moon or something, why would the charge equality of all the bodies suddenly become so unequal? Where would the charge differential come from if the solar wind has been constantly bleeding away charge and making everything equal for millions and millions of years?
That's a good question. It comes down to looking at the bigger picture of the galaxy itself, which plasma cosmologists have shown is an electrical circuit with current flowing along the spiral arms into the center of the galaxy. and the stars are caught up in that, which means that we're just part of a circuit. So there's no, we don't actually achieve equilibrium at any time. If we did, the sun would go out. So that maintains a stable electrical environment, but it also means that there is a voltage difference as you move out from the sun, so that the planets sit at a spot where the voltage is different from each other.
But wait. That's a really crucial point. That's an amazingly important point.
Yes,
which you submerge. You never brought that out before, because that's a really critical physical foundation. If electrical fields are different at different distances from the star, from the sun,
yes,
then they have to have an innate difference. So if you do bring them together, all hell will break loose.
That's right.
The streams. Remember that?
Yeah. Well, this is why comets discharge as they approach the sun. It's because the...
In the electric universe model.
Yeah, they're traveling from a region in the outer solar system where the voltage is different to that closer into the sun. And the faster they approach the sun, the more difficulty the comet has in achieving equilibrium. So it discharges more strongly and its coma increases. The coma is that envelope that it grows, which can be as big as the sun.
Right.
And that is entirely an electrical event. It's got nothing to do with matter being...
Well, speaking of comas, remember that the Rosetta people just announced in the last couple of days, in fact, that's one of my links up in my section tonight in Radio with Pictures, mm-hmm. they've discovered an incredible chemistry, a soup, a delicious soup, an exobiologist dream, wet dream,
yes.
including glycine.
Yes.
In your model, where does this interesting goopy stuff that life is made of come from, if not in kind of something approaching their model as comets being primordial bits of stuff that made the system back in the beginning?
Well, the electrical model, the jets are electric arcs, which are actually cathode arcs.
Okay.
Now, cathode arcs...
But cathode arcs on what? What's the comet body itself? What are these things?
It's rocky. So
okay.
What it's doing is tearing atoms out of the rocks. That's the oxygen.
Okay.
All of the things that you see, the carbon and so on, and nitrogen.
So and you are saying the comets are rocky, even if they're not dirty snowballs. They are... material. They're stuff.
Yes, yes. Yeah, they're made of the stuff of a planet.
Okay.
So they have all the material.
They have silicates. They have all that good stuff.
Yep. And in tearing apart those minerals on the surface, you end up with electrochemistry, which is something that astronomers seem to have difficulty with.
I wonder why. we'll get into some of those why questions in the last half hour. We'll also have you guys join us for our conversation. Let me give out some numbers here. I'm glad we reminded ourselves. You can call us on Skype, Enterprise Mission, or The Other Side of Midnight. Our phone number, if you dial us, if anywhere in the world, we can pick up, I think if Skype's fixed, 505-796-8802. That's 505-796-8802. Or our toll-free line at KCAA there in the Inland Empire, 888-909-1050. 888-909-1050. All those ways to reach us. You could also try telepathy, but since I'm not very good at it and I don't know about Wallace, you know, probably I would use a phone, you know. So, we are on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Wallace Thornhill. We are discussing a totally different way of looking at how the universe interacts with itself and how folks like us ultimately got produced. We shall return with those thoughts and your questions and comments. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
What have I learned so far? Well, I've learned there's no one right path for everyone. I've learned that without my high school diploma, I could only do so much. My options were limited, very limited. I found a free personalized learning program with Learn for Life that has a flexible schedule so I can keep my job while earning my high school diploma. I found a new career with training opportunities that would jumpstart my future. What have I learned so far? I've learned that I could change my life.
Are you 14 to 19 years old and looking for a free high school diploma program with flexible meeting times? This program allows you to keep your job or important family responsibilities while earning your high school diploma. If you've fallen behind on credits or dropped out of school completely, get back on track with free tutoring, a caring faculty, and one-on-one attention. For more information on how to reach your graduation goal, visit learnforlife.org. That's L-E-A-R-N, the number 4, L-I-F-E, .org. Or enroll today by calling 877-360-LEARN. That's 877-360-LEARN.
Plexus Slim, the pink drink. It works. Consider the following. 95% of all diets and weight loss programs fail. 8 out of 10 Americans over the age of 25 are overweight. And 174 million Americans are overweight. Finally, there is a healthy solution to help you lose weight. The synergistic effect of Plexus Slim and Plexus 96 taken together can help you lose more weight faster than you ever thought possible. Experience quick results and keep the weight off. People around the country are experiencing amazing results, and you can too. Plus, right now, you can try it free for 7 days. Just email your name, address, and phone number for a free sample to tryplexusfree at gmail.com. Tryplexusfree at gmail.com. Plexus Slim, the pink drink. It works.
Attention business owners. Do you know your online business score? Google and other major search engines now score your business based on several key areas. That's your directory listings, any ratings, and positive and negative reviews. Find out your online business score at whatsmybusinessscore.com. Statistics show that 70% of customers trust a business with a minimum of 6 to 10 reviews. whatsmybusinessscore.com will show you what your potential customers will see online about your business so you can do something about it. Your online business score can affect where search engines place your company in local search results. Having accurate directory listings and staying on top of your company's reputation is super important now. Go to whatsmybusinessscore.com and take the first step in gaining control of your business's online presence. whatsmybusinessscore.com will scan all the top directories and review sites and show you your score, as well as any reviews or directory listings that may be inaccurate, all at no cost. Go to whatsmybusinessscore.com. That's whatsmybusinessscore.com today.
Music's playing. And welcome back, everyone. My guest this morning, Wallace Thornhill. We're discussing the electric universe. I'm getting some interesting questions coming in through Skype, through our producer. Let me read you a couple of them, okay? Here's an interesting one. How does the Goldilocks zone of planets, ones that contain water and support life, play into the electric universe idea?
Okay. The Goldilocks zone is a very inhospitable place to be to start life and generate a planet like the Earth. My view is that the astronomers are right, that life would be better placed starting around a red dwarf, but not in the way that astronomers think, because their view of red dwarfs, as I said before, is wrong. The red outer shell of a red star is a huge anode glow which sits well above the surface of the body inside. There was actually evidence from NASA a few years ago where this was shown to be the case, where they had to propose the idea that a red dwarf was actually two red dwarfs, exactly the same, identical twins, to produce the amount of light that it was putting out. And I said, no, it's just a single star. It's just that its envelope is huge, and planets orbit within that glow. And inside that glow, it's a very interesting environment, which has been looked at closely by one of my colleagues in regard to the earliest stories and memories of mankind about the purple dawn of creation, they called it.
The purple dawn of creation?
Yes, where the sky color was purple. It was red and the blue end of the spectrum combined, because ultraviolet and blue is also part of the light from this plasma glow. But the important thing is that the infrared and red end of the spectrum is just what plants need. Plants respond powerfully to the red end of the spectrum. And it also seems that the dinosaurs also had very large eyes because the light was much dimmer than we experience today. So the environment on Earth was quite different to anything we experience now. But the advantage of living inside a glowing shell is that every square meter on the Earth would have received the same amount of energy. So you could have tropical plants growing in the Arctic and the Antarctic, which is, of course, what we find. We find coal deposits there. So a lot of these geological anomalies are answered by this idea that planets inside this red glow are the places, they're the cosmic wombs of life. The interesting thing is that if Mars was also a member of that group, it quite possibly had life on it as well. But it got terribly damaged in the breakup. I can't go into it here. It'd take too long to talk about. But it suffered terribly in the breakup, and it was witnessed by ancients, the battles with Venus and also the attacks on the Earth. The Mars, the god of war.
Now, you're interpreting this from texts, ancient texts. What are the textual sources? Are we talking about Dead Sea Scrolls? Are we talking about something much more ancient, something very multicultural?
Yes, you go back to the very earliest recollections of mankind, and some of those you'll find amongst the natives of various continents and also of islands in the out in the Pacific and so on.
Well, who in particular?
You'd have to have a look. I don't have that information right in front of me, but there's been a series of books written by one of my colleagues, Duardo Cardona, called the Star Series, which are available on the thunderbolts.info website. And the amount of research he has done, and I lost count of how many pages his books run to now, and he's almost finished another. But the Star Series talks about this period, this early period of the Earth and what it was like and the geological evidence and so on. So for anyone who wants to follow it up, the information is available. It's just so much of it that I can't, I don't have a memory that good. But the general picture is that that's where life is most likely to be found. The interesting thing is also that one of the aspects of red dwarfs is that they flare occasionally, which means that the atmosphere and surface material on those bodies is largely the material thrown out by the red dwarf. And one of the aspects, I said Saturn was our red dwarf. That's the husk that's left of it. And it has water ice in its rings. So the Earth's water came from its parent, Saturn, and also Mars probably had an ocean or had water as well.
So you believe that this system is the result of the melding of two previous solar systems, one that had the gas giants except for Saturn.
Yes.
And one that was Saturn orbited by Earth, Mars, and Venus.
And a lot of other minor bodies.
Okay.
Now,
when they came together, how come they didn't collide, careen past each other? What caused the planets to stop motion around their respective centers and decide to orbit around a common center, resulting in Saturn slash the red dwarf orbiting the sun, which is much more massive?
Well, as I said, electrical exchange was a large part of it. The ancients remember the breakup of the system as forming like a giant comet with us sitting in the tail. And that tail was an electrical discharge, as I said, all comets discharge electrically. But this one gave birth to all of those weird plasma forms that were carved on rock and so on, and gave rise to the legends of the cosmic.
So this melding was within human memory?
Yes.
So that means it has to be within... I mean, we're not going to restrict ourselves to 6,000 years of recorded history, which is a tiny drop in the bucket.
Yes.
But you're saying that humanity, Homo sapiens, somehow is old enough to have maintained a record of this encounter. Roughly when do you think, or do the texts say anything about roughly when this may have happened?
No, because it was impossible to keep time until we actually had the sun in the sky and we could see differences between day and night and shadows on bodies and so on. But the last ice age was the final throes of us adjusting to our present orbit. So you're looking at tens of thousands of years.
So in a solar system of billions, you're talking yesterday.
Yes. Okay. But this whole idea of aging stars and so on is it's a story. It's a construct. No one was there to see it happen. And now we're beginning
to find... You mean you don't think that time actually flows entropically from one moment to the next?
Oh, yes, I didn't say that. In fact, time is universal.
Okay, so if time exists, then how come... Why are you cavalierly throwing out that the solar system is billions of years old?
Because the whole idea of dating came about through the astronomers needing more and more time to... or the geologists needing more and more time to explain what they saw... And the astronomers having difficulties because they couldn't see how the sun could continue to shine that long. And then along came nuclear energy, and so they made up a story about how nuclear energy does it.
So you really think that stars are not fueled internally, but they are basically like Christmas tree lights, and that they are all connected in these vast galactic-wide interstellar currents.
Yes.
But if that's true, I mean, our sun is no mean piker when it comes out to putting out energy. If all that energy is actually flowing into it from outside and it's only glowing like some kind of resistor?
No. The electrical energy in the plasma is sufficient to engender the nuclear reactions that we see taking place there. And when I say we see, the neutrino telescope or the neutrino detections coming from the sun show that the nuclear reactions are taking place there, but it's in the photosphere. It's not in the core. There's nothing going on in the core. All bodies in the solar, in the universe have planetary-type centers. It's only the larger ones that become stars, and it depends on their environment. The star is reliant on its environment. The evidence.
So what do you do with the evidence from a discipline of astronomy, astrophysics, devoted to the sun called helioseismology? There's a whole science kind of in parallel with the audience might not be, in parallel with seismology, looking at earthquakes and mapping the internal structures of the earth, looking at various vibrations. There's a parallel science that's able now to interpret starlight, Doppler effects of the star surface heaving up and down, and to map that into an internal model of sound refractions and reflections that allow them to model the internal dynamics and pressures of the sun. And those two models, the original model of equations of state and the helioseismological models testing it, they're pretty close. So it looks like that the concentric model of the sun with an incredibly hot core, 20 million plus degrees, and a very cool surface, 10,000 degrees, is what we're dealing with. And you're saying that that data is not real and there's another interpretation.
Of course, there's another interpretation. The helioseismology is based on the model. So whatever you find is then just referred back to the model. It's like a hall of mirrors.
Well, wait. When you say model, you know, they assume that the material of which the sun is made has a certain conductivity for sound, velocity of sound.
Sure, and but they're assuming what's inside the sun.
What they do is they try a whole bunch of different ideas, and then they kind of shrink it down to one that gives the observations, because you're always working to what you're seeing. So it's not like it's a shot in the dark. It's like you can have wildly divergent materials and models that don't work, and the one that does seem to work actually has an incredibly super hot core where something is going on in the center of the sun. That's the one that satisfies the helioseismological observations of sound waves in the sun and on the surface.
The problem you face is that when you start doing simulations, all you get out is what you put in. Computer simulations can only do that. And it leaves unexplained a whole lot of observations of the sun. In fact, practically all of the observations that we have made on the sun and above the sun have no relationship to the actual theoretical model of the sun. You would not predict any of them from the theoretical model. So what you do is you then add various barnacles to the theory until you make something that looks a bit like what you see.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic, one of the basic things about the sun is that sunspots are dark. Now, the electric universe model says that's so because once you punch a hole in that electric photosphere and you see beneath it, you're seeing a body which isn't doing anything. You know, it's just an electrical body which is receiving charge from the galactic circuit.
So you're of William Herschel's several hundred years old model that the sunspots are kind of holes in the solar atmosphere and you're looking to a darker, cool surface underneath a glowing halo.
You're looking at the top of the ionosphere. It's just like the Earth. It has its glowing ionosphere too, which has holes punched in it occasionally by electrical discharges, those sprites that you see heading up into the ionosphere. The same thing happens on the sun, only they're far more violent and interesting to watch because they're in the visible part of the spectrum. So all electrical bodies have this plasma sheath which behaves in ways which are dependent upon the density of the power that's impinging on that body. And the sun is no different. And the fact that you find neutrinos of all flavors coming from the sun suggests that what is going on there is far more complex than is given credit. It's producing heavy elements right before our eyes. The other aspect of the electric universe is that it takes on board all of the plasma cosmologists' peer-reviewed work and shows that it fits beautifully. And you're talking here about Nobel Prize winners and so on in the past, but their cosmology is ignored by astronomers, and yet they've been the most successful ones in explaining and predicting things that would be found. For
like,
instance,
like who, for example?
Oh, Hans Alfvén was one of the key guys. Yeah, and they predicted that
he
stars
was a huge, big plasma physics guy. Wallace, I'm going to make you very jealous. I have a personally signed copy of one of Alfvén's textbooks that he wrote and handed to me in San Diego at a space conference many decades ago. It's one of my most cherished possessions because Alfvén, a fellow Swede, correctly assessed that the universe is much more plasma dynamic than mainstream astronomy apparently wants to think about.
Yes, he's one of my heroes. But I think it's interesting to note that in recent times, astronomers have been able to peer through these dark clouds of dust where stars are forming, and hey presto, they found exactly what the plasma cosmologists predicted, that they would be formed like beads on a string, and that once that discharge fades, they would scatter like buckshot. And it's only in the last month or so that they've discovered, strangely, that the stars in those regions are scattering like buckshot.
Ah. Can you send me a link on that, please?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Because the next question I want to ask you is, have you looked at planetary nebula?
Yes.
Have you seen the most exquisite, amazing, absolutely astonishing, impossible geometries?
That's right.
In those embryos, those nurseries of something. Supposedly, yes. Planetary nebula are the nebulas formed when stars are dying.
Yes, they've got it back to the front.
I was going to say, what if they're how stars are formed? Because Alfvén talked about the electrical creation in the plasma rings of the forming solar system of various paired planets.
Yes.
Very similar to Van Flandern's ideas of paired planet creation.
Yes, Tom Van Flandern also wrote some very good work.
Oh, didn't he?
he
is so missed. He is just so missed.
Yes, that was very sad. I think the important thing here is, once again, the prediction of plasma cosmologists has been far more accurate than astronomers, but the astronomers, with the old left brain working overtime, rejects it, which is terrible because they should at least look at the alternative and weigh it up against what they're saying. You know, but this isn't done. Science isn't being done the way it was meant to be done.
Hmm. Speaking, by the way, of something we talked about earlier, comets, did you ever hear the video or the music video, The Music of 67P?
Yes, I did.
I think we've got it here. I think if I can call this up.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will come up. Okay. Here we are. Now, this is an actual recording from the Rosetta spacecraft, from the plasma experiments, of shaking in that plasma at a particularly incredibly rhythmic frequency. Now, they've upped the frequency so we can hear it in the audible range.
Yes.
That's all they've done, is they've just changed the frequency. They haven't changed the rate of the frequency change. This is what 67P is putting out.
Mm.
Why? Does the electric universe model predict anything like this?
Yes, it does. In fact, one of the key issues that the electric universe addresses is resonance, in the universe, and its electrical resonances. And because they're all parts of circuits, circuits have resonant frequencies, so that you expect to have resonances and connections between matter, which extends into the realm of biology, actually, where there's a signaling system that biologists are not aware of, which is very subtle, rather like the connection between planets was very subtle through gravity. So that this is one of the other things that will be talked about at our conference, by the way, is electrobiology. And I think it's one aspect of the electric universe which will have profound influence in the future, because it tends to marry up natural therapies with the kind of work that's being done currently in medicine.
That's just amazing. I mean, that's real. It's natural. Ha ha ha. Or is it? Have you ever considered, Wallace, that the comets you're looking at, the incredible anomalies, are anomalous because they're not natural objects at all? They're actually huge, ancient Dyson-type spacecraft?
Well, I know of one or two people who have been looking for evidence of something that could not be explained on the surface of Comet 67P.
Oh, there's a whole bunch of interesting things that cannot be explained.
But in particular, when you look at it just from my point of view, the geological point of view, you can see that there are strata and so on in that body.
Now, how does an object the size of 2 miles, the size of Berkeley, how does it develop gravity so you get stratification?
It can't.
It can't.
That's what, no. It has to be a part of a larger body which underwent differentiation and planetary.
So now are we back to Tom Van Flandern's model? In other words, is 67P a fragment of the fourth planet that blew up?
Yes. Tom did some excellent work in charting the orbits of asteroids and comets, and said that it looks like it all occurred due to a major event at some time in the past. The only problem was he had no plausible explanation for an exploding planet. What I would suggest is...
You mean he didn't have an energy source?
That's right. No one's shown how a planet can explode, but if you hark back to what I was saying earlier, the encounters between Mars and the Earth, and Venus and Mars and so, and the Earth, it must have happened in that region somewhere coming in from the outer solar system. And that's where you find all the asteroids, and that's where you find the cometary orbits all seem to point to something happening in that area, which was dramatic. And I think the very fact that we still get meteorites from Mars is a prime example of this is the kind of thing you would expect in that scenario, but it's hard to explain or you know, difficult to explain in standard astronomical terms.
Okay. We have barely scratched the surface of this because it's such an interesting cosmology. I've got another question here that came in from one of our listeners. Let me see if I can find where it is. Here we are. Okay. This is from Michael. Could you have him comment, he says, about you, about supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies? Are they real, or is it part of a misinterpretation?
It's a misinterpretation. In fact, the physics of black holes just doesn't bear investigation.
As a phenomenon in and of itself.
Yes, that's right. Mathematically, it fails as well. But
so you can't
answer,
crunch matter together and create a singularity where it falls through to somewhere else?
No. First, you have to understand gravity, and then you have to understand the electrical nature of matter. When you combine those two, apart from the mathematics, it's just an impossibility. But there's a very simple answer, and the plasma cosmologists provided it a long time ago. In fact, Eric Lerner, in his book, The Big Bang Never Happened,
brilliant
shows...
Brilliant book.
Yes. He shows that it's a plasmoid. It has all of the effects expected of a plasmoid, and if you hark back to what I said right near the beginning, E equals MC squared, if you funnel huge amounts of electrical energy into a plasmoid, it effectively has a tremendous amount of mass in a small volume, maybe, say, the volume of the solar system.
So you're basically talking T. Townsend Brown conversion of electromagnetic energy into mass, which creates changes in orbits. I mean, we're charting now the orbits of many stars orbiting very close to the supposed, presumed, theorized supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way, which is supposed to be about 4 million times the mass of the sun. And you look at these stars, you know, within a few, you know, light hours going around like bats out of hell.
That's right.
They're obviously being gravitationally affected by something. You say it's not a classical black hole. You say it's what?
It's a plasmoid. And the energy stored gives you, according to E equals MC squared, huge amount of energy, huge amount of mass in a small space. So there's no real puzzle there at all. And the jets that come out of it are exactly what you get in the laboratory when a plasmoid has a hiccup.
Except a hiccup on this scale can be very dangerous for the planetary civilization living within how many light years? Thousands of light years? 26,000? Hey, we're at the end of the show. Plug the conference again so people can go and get a close-up and personal look at this extraordinary cosmology.
Good. It's EU 2016, June 17 to 19 in Phoenix, Arizona. If you go to thunderbolts.info, the homepage has it emblazoned at the top of the screen.
And you have some books. You've written many books.
The two books that are written with David Talbot, my colleague, the Thunderbolts of the Gods, which gives the evidence for these electrical exchanges between planets.
Are you telling us that the whole Thor Marvel movie universe thing is really about planets smashing electrical bolts into each other?
Yes, the planets don't actually collide. In fact, once you understand gravity, you realize that they try and avoid collisions, but they exchange electrical thunderbolts in the process of trying to avoid collision.
That would be an astonishing view. My God. All right, we only got a couple minutes left. Do you believe in extraterrestrial life? Do you think we're it, or is there somebody else out there?
No, all those red dwarfs out there, they outnumber the bright stars, so there must be a huge amount of life out there. The funny thing is that they cannot transmit radio signals or receive them through that plasma envelope. So the SETI organization are attempting to use Stone Age technology, if you like, to try and communicate with intelligent life.
Well, that sounds like a bummer.
You mean the basic
physics of the technology they're trying to use is forbidden because of the plasma spheres around the stars where most likely intelligent civilizations might be hanging out?
Yes, radio signals, I'm afraid.
So what could penetrate? Lasers?
No, thought.
Okay, so we're back now into consciousness experiments, and that's a whole other conversation.
It is.
So we'll have to do that. We only got a minute here left, so what would you like to contrast in terms of politically where we are at the beginning of your process to where we are now tonight? Is the mainstream beginning to look at these ideas any more acceptably than they have in the past?
No, I think because of their training, they are more or less with a disability. So I'm relying on the general public to listen and compare these ideas with what they're seeing on television. And the general response is they can't bear watching those television programs anymore because they can see all the errors and problems that the electric universe addresses simply that they're trying to answer with metaphysics.
Have you ever thought of doing what Greer has done and do a docudrama or a documentary from the electric universe perspective?
I'd love to.
Okay, and it's a matter of funding, of course. Crowdsourcing is very good these days. There's a lot of people wanting to put money in things that will make a difference. Tell you what, we will talk about that next time you're back. Unfortunately, we're at the end of the show. Thank you so much, Wallace, for being a guest on The Other Side of Midnight. We will definitely have you back.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you. So until tomorrow morning, same time, same bat channel, and tomorrow is open hailing frequencies. It's 1 week to the major California primary. It's Bernie and Hillary and actually a lot of other things. So until tomorrow morning, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.